Brian Had a Dream, 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
Hi, I'm Ben.
I'm Brian.
And welcome once again to the quest for 10,000. Thank you so much for joining us on Brian's quest to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. Thank you for listening, for downloading, and hopefully for sharing this podcast with a friend. Today, our big topic is the second part of a discussion about faith in film. Today, we dive into specifics, examples about movies that deal with faith well and movies that deal with faith not so well. But before we get to that, we want to talk with Brian about an example of his faith being rewarded. Brian, you were on vacation this past week, and who did you happen to see?
So it was exciting. At the end of the day, the story is not earth-shattering. But I'm on vacation in the panhandle of Florida, going to lunch with my family, and we're pulling in looking for a parking place. And as we circle the parking lot, we're heading one way, and this golf cart, because everybody in panhandle of Florida is that you live there has a golf cart, and that's how they travel. And this guy is just golf cart's going by, and I'm looking on the back of the golf cart, just hanging out, is my one of my heroes, Bill Murray.
All right.
Don't know who the elderly lady was that was driving the golf cart and why Bill wasn't driving the golf cart, but he was just kind of hanging out, checking out the sights, looking around, and it was pretty exciting.
Did you get a chance to talk to him?
Unfortunately, he sped off before we could get near him to really say anything. I snagged a few pictures, and I had to convince my wife it was Bill Murray. She said it wasn't, but I said, I know Bill Murray, and that was Bill Murray.
Oh, well, there you go. Did you relive the day at all, Groundhog Day style?
Unfortunately, not yet. So,
would you do anything different? Maybe call out Ned Ryerson?
I might go needle nose Ned the head, or I might ask him, "What is the weather going to be like tomorrow?"
Well, that's an incredible step on your journey for 10,000. Definitely a high moment, but. While on vacation, did you have a chance to watch any other films? And if so, where are you then on the march towards 10,000?
Yeah, like most days, I only probably got in one, either in the morning or night after people went to bed. I am right now at 6,764.
All right, and what is the last movie you remember seeing?
Well, the last one I watched today was this movie from about 15, 16 years ago called The Yards. And I hadn't heard of it, but it has Joaquin Phoenix, Charlize Theron, James Caan, Mark Wahlberg, Ellen Burstyn. So it's got a good pedigree, and it's about corruption in, politics and corruption in unions and stuff in bidding contracts for the subway tunnels in New York.
Riveting. Okay, then what's the a great movie that you've seen since last we talked?
Well, I watched a movie on TCM, also watched it this morning, Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant movie that I had not really heard of, called Holiday from 1938. Most people, if you've heard of the two of them together, Philadelphia Story, you may know Bringing Up Baby. Those are both great films, but this movie, Holiday, really good. I mean, it's about an idealistic sort of dreamer that falls in love or is engaged to this social climber in the 30s, this daughter of a social climber who they're obsessed with wealth and they want to make more money. She thinks when she marries him that he will get a job at the bank and conform to her ideal of what a perfect husband and a perfect life should be. He comes into some money and he says, okay, now that I have some money, why don't I, for a couple of years, live my life the way I want to and see what comes of it. I want to really go out and experience the world. I don't want to be tied to a desk or be, a banker. But for right now, if that doesn't work out, I can always fall back on it. And there's a conflict, and Katharine Hepburn is the sister of the girl, and she sort of takes his side. It's really good.
Well, great. All right, so thumbs up on Holiday.
Middle of the road for The Yards.
Well, we're going to be talking about some films, some that are good, some that are much less than middle of the road, as we now move into our big topic for this episode, Faith on Film Part 2, talking about specific examples of movies that do well with the themes of faith and spiritual development, and films that we think don't do all that well with those same themes. Now, we talked last episode a lot about how maybe every film, in some sense, could be a film about faith, in that every film tries to express some sort of truth or belief of its director, its creators, and that sort of thing. But what we're really talking about here are probably films that more explicitly have faith as some sort of central tenet, and particularly probably the Christian faith, being that we're in the U.S., and that tends to be just the faith that dominates most of our entertainment, pop culture expressions, at least so far in the things that Brian and I are most familiar with. Brian, what in general, again, do you think makes depictions of faith a little bit more, let's say, palatable than not in different films?
Okay. The less obvious it is, the more palatable it will be. The more subtlety, the better it's going to be as an entertaining and or artistic experience. But now, it depends on what you're trying to, you know, from my point of view, for evangelical films or films that are specifically designed to propagate a certain faith or a certain idea of faith or a certain brand of faith, if you will, those movies tend to me to be the least successful.
Yeah, okay. So give me, and maybe we'll just talk through several of these examples, but give me, you know, two or three examples of films that you think capture that subtlety very well in terms of sharing some kind of message about spirituality and about faith in God, or even in the, you know, the faith that we adhere to, the Christian faith. What do you think are some good examples?
It's been my experience that the best movies to deal with faith that's not always true, but as a general rule, Europeans have a better way of dealing with faith in issues like in medium like that than Americans do. Particularly the ones that I've, you know, like there's some Ingmar Bergman films that are very spiritually probing. There are a few by a guy, a Dane from Denmark, Carl Theodor Dreyer, who worked up until the middle of the 50s, and some of his films are really good. But Bergman in particular had a trilogy of films called, one of them was, I think the capper to the trilogy was called The Silence, and it was, he started with the idea of what do you do when you are struggling with existential questions or grief or something, and you ask in God and you get no response? Like, how do you deal with that silence? Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, but he's not beating you over the head by trying to give you answers. And that's one thing I think that's important too. Movies that ask questions are better than movies that give you answers.
Right. Right. Okay. And I hear what you're saying. Yeah, probably European filmmakers in general probably have a subtler, lighter touch in some ways with existential matters sometimes than U.S. directors do. Maybe it's just different also, to be fair, in the expectations of audiences of the team.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, too, it's about who finances it. Big studios in America, Hollywood studios, are typically not financing explicit religious films. That they want to stay away from that sort of controversy. You know, even with the success of something like The Passion of the Christ, they're not looking to bring in people with that sort of audience. They're not going for that usually, because they're reluctant to, for whatever reason. Europeans aren't necessarily as worried about it. And that's why when you say art house cinema, you typically mean something that it, at minimum, was financed by with European money, not necessarily is a European film. But
well, some other, though, examples I would say of U.S. filmmaking that I've seen that's done, I think, interesting things, particularly again with Christian faith. The movie Saved, I don't remember who wrote, directed that sort of thing. I know it starred Mandy Moore, mm-hmm. I believe, and the.
It was a parody movie, right?
It was. Well, it was a parody of a certain kind, an expression of faith, and sort of poking some holes in hypocrisy, mm-hmm. perhaps, of expressions of Christian faith. This kind of idea of holiness, but we're all kind of messed up and, you know, none of us really are as pure as we try to project. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the central pieces of it was, you know, a ministry that was trying to convert homosexuals into heterosexuals and, mm-hmm. and sort of the fallacy of those kind of ministries out there was part of its message. But also one in the end of just sort of saying, look, you know, part of faith is really about being authentic and about being honest with ourselves.
Well, I will say, we said that American films are not as good. I think American films are probably better at satirizing faith and religious institutions. I'm thinking of movies like Dogma, like Saved. If there's an element of dark humor or just poking holes in logical inconsistencies. You know, even if you want, it's not necessarily filmmaking, but even if you go to something like South Park, which is constantly skewering our preconceived notions of religion and its place in our society and how, you know, you get from point A to point B, but right. you skipped over all this stuff in between to get there. I don't think Europeans are as worried about that, but we are. Certainly American films take a darker, you know, look at it. So I will say they have an edge there. But yeah. As far as serious films about, you know, that don't – serious films about faith that are not pandering, you don't find many. You know, the ones that are released in the United States, they seem to be the kind that are more or less like big pat yourself on the back for you're the good guys.
Right. Already on this podcast, that's a good probably way to talk about a movie you've already – mentioned on this podcast, I believe.
Gosh.
God Is Not Dead, Part 1, because there is a sequel.
I love the fact that God's Not Dead 2, Still Not Dead. I mean, I love that. I love that there's a sequel to a movie about God not being dead.
You know, and God not, that's probably been one of the more popular type of films you've talked about that seem to be evangelical in nature. A precursor to those films, though, is one I feel like I've got to mention. My wife said I needed to mention for its abject, in her opinion and mine, some of its real difficulties and just kind of horribleness. The movie Facing the Giants, mm-hmm. In which it really goes back to what you're saying. It's a movie trying to give you all these sorts of answers and leaving no real ambiguity or questions. Facing the Giants is about this football team, this high school football team that basically decides to give itself, commit itself to the Lord, and suddenly they start winning. The coach and his wife have not been able to have a child, and suddenly she gets pregnant because the football team's winning or because now they have given themselves to God. There's this kid very early on. I mean, you know the movie's name is Facing the Giants. So if you have any kind of familiarity with some biblical stories and iconic kind of stories within the Judeo-Christian Bible, when you see that the kicker's name is David, you kind of realize that in the end, he's going to win the game against the Giants by kicking a field goal, you know, David tackles Goliath and everything. They win a state championship. It's just, on the one hand, it's just not really a well-made movie. Like, the acting's bad. And on top of that, for me, you know, theology just doesn't leave any room for any kind of doubt, any kind of questions, any kind of like, well, what about this? Is could there be another way to look at that?
I mean, okay.
No real interpretation. And that really bothers me in matters of
religion. I don't mind films that show that a couple that can't conceive a child, that they pray to God, and God is able to worked in his miraculous way to give them a child. I don't mind that. I don't like are films that imply that the people that doesn't work out for, somehow they just weren't religious enough.
Right.
Like, I don't, you know, and too many times I think movies, the way they present it is not God worked a miracle for this family. It presents it as a way of, like, if you are faithful enough, God will work a miracle for you.
Yeah, and it kind of reduces faith to a formula.
Yeah.
I find that problematic and off-putting. And then, and also, it's just, you know, the acting isn't all that
it's
great.
Always, yeah, no, it's always...
The
yeah.
script is kind of wooden and...
Well, I mean, I think what they do is, it's self-congratulatory. It is a way for you to... it almost becomes, among some churches, it almost becomes a competition to say, see, we went and saw this movie, so we... or can prove our churchiness.
Right.
And, you know, and they realize that. And I don't know, I'm not questioning the sincerity of the people making the films, but I am questioning the sincerity of the people funding the films, because I think they realize that if you keep the budget at a certain level, you have a self-built-in audience that you can just serve it up to them, and you're going to make money. Now, you're not going to make a ton of money, but occasionally you might hit something out of the park, like Passion of the Christ, which is, may or may not be the same type of, but the same sort of mentality drove it, you know, gave it that baseline level of this is its box office, because you just know that at some cities you're going to be able to set out whole theaters for a week or so with churches just coming in to see the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you know that, so you can give them what they want, but you know, romance novels are bestsellers too. That doesn't mean they're good.
Right. We're probably getting to the point where we need to move on to our top five. But before we go, just a couple other films to mention, I think, okay, that fall on the good sort of part of faith. Another one we've talked about before, Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm. Not Christian faith, but Harold Ramis himself, a Buddhist, and talked about how that was his depiction of the perfection of the soul, an essential tenet of Buddhism. So that one, I think, you sort of have to hold up as a movie that's about faith in a lot of ways, but just not a faith perhaps most of our U.S. culture is as familiar with. And then as we get to our top five, we just have to mention, to transition there, the Coen brothers. Probably creators, filmmakers that do more with concepts of faith in their films as a whole than any other filmmaker I'm familiar with. There are so many films, A Brother Where Art Thou, Barton Fink, their newest, Hail Caesar, that deal with different aspects of faith and depictions, both some of the hypocrisy and some of the power of it as well.
I'll even say that the movie A Serious Man is also a highly religious film. And even you can argue, well,
Jewish background there,
yeah,
right?
Sure. And, yeah, yeah. And they are certainly Jewish. And then also you can look at Fargo and talk about it's a good man who is suckered into this moral, you know, depravity. Mm-hmm. And you know, most of their films have to do with some sort of, like, not a bright line of good versus evil, but the capacity of all people for good and or evil. Yeah.
Well, and it seems also in each film there's at least one scene or one character who sort of seems to be some kind of voice about religion, or mm-hmm. some sort of window character into that topic. And that's really what our top five this week may be about in some ways. Maybe some of those characters will come up, because since we're talking about faith on film and the Coens as being filmmakers who seem to do faith on film in ways that are most appealing to Brian and I, we thought our top five for this week would be Brian's top five Coen Brothers films characters. So, Brian, this is a little bit different topic in a top five than we've done before. Was this one a little bit tougher to kind of get everything together for you?
Yeah, I don't have, like, a handy list that I can go to and pull up, and that I've pre-ranked. So it requires a little bit more front-end effort on my part to sort of come up. Because some of them, you forget some of the characters, and you're like, yeah, I remember that movie, but who was that character in that movie? So, yeah, that certainly happens.
That's good to know, Brian. Without any further ado, though, who is your number five Coen brother character?
Well, number five is from a movie that I think gets underrated, and it's, at least as far as most people in the Coen brothers filmography, maybe because it's a little more difficult to kind of get inside of. But I'm going to go with John Goodman's character in Barton Fink, Charlie Meadows. He may or may not, he may just be a figment of the main character's imagination. It's sort of left kind of nebulous in a way. But he has a couple of scenes where they're one-on-one in this room where he just, it's intense, it's crazy, and it just sticks with me. It's one of the reasons I love that movie, because those scenes just absolutely stick with me. And it just, I just love John Goodman and can't say enough about that movie.
And John Goodman, I mean, it strikes me, we could have just asked, what's John Goodman's top five roles in Coen brother films? Possibly.
Certainly.
That way.
Certainly, yeah. And if you've read any recent interviews with Goodman, he is such a likable person and just such a phenomenal talent. And, history may very well remember him primarily as Roseanne's husband in the sitcom, but there's so much more to him than that.
So John Goodman, underrated John Goodman in an underrated Coen brothers film, Barton Fink. Mm-hmm. Who's number four?
Number four is going to be from No Country for Old Men, Anton, I'm not sure how to say the last name, but Javier Bardem. If you've seen the movie, you know the character. He is one of the coolest, psychopaths. I don't mean that cool isn't a good cool, but I mean not just cold characters and just so supremely rational and just, rational in the sense that evil and good don't exist for him.
Would you say he's sort of a nihilism? Would that be? Is he a nihilist?
Yeah, he's one of the nihilists.
We have nothing. That's Lebowski. We won't be crossing the streams here, but still, yeah. No, yeah, that performance received
the movie's a very good movie, and I think it sort of showed us what Josh Brolin was capable of as an actor. I think I don't remember him being in anything before then that was really like, wow, this guy can really, because in essence, Josh Brolin is Tommy Lee Jones 2.0, right?
A little bit.
The fact they're both in that movie, but anyhow, it's fantastic, and they're all great in it. But without Bardem's character in that movie does not quite get elevated to the level that it does with his character.
Right. All right, number three.
Number three, I'm gonna go back to John Goodman, and I'm gonna go to one of his probably most memorable performances, and I think one of the things that'll probably be leading the stories in his obituary is his performance as Walter in The Big Lebowski. I don't think you can remember John Goodman without immediately seeing this guy with his bowling ball just yelling about Vietnam. And it's just such a perfect character for the role. The role itself was supposed to be based on stories of John Milius, a famed director that was friends with Spielberg and Lucas but never quite could get the breaks they did. But they all... And there's a documentary about him recently where they all believed, and I take them at their word, that he was probably the most talented of that group to come through the UCLA or USC film school. But for whatever reason, his politics, his bizarre personality, at one point he went into a meeting with a producer, and he asked to be paid by them purchasing him this really rare and expensive gun. because this guy, just the guy that really is sort of crazy, but that the character of Walter was based in large part on just anecdotes of this guy's.
And you're right, Goodman just embodies that role.
Oh, he does. I mean, he's just.
And again, really the element of that movie, that's, I think you're right, even though there's lots of great performances in that, Goodman sort of Yeah, light the rug just kind of brings the whole thing.
Well, one thing I'll say about Walter in that movie is the reason that Walter works is because he is the perfect counterpoint to segue into my number two character, the dude.
The dude abides.
Whereas Walter is just this one huge frayed nerve of a character. The dude is like this dude that is all of these horrifying things are just happening around him, but he maintains this level of distance from it. You never see him really get incredibly riled up considering the circumstances of what is going on around him. It seems to be kind of laconic. And, just this perfect – and how he got to be friends with Walter is also beyond – comprehension to a certain degree. How these two people
it's not necessarily true of the actors who play him, Jeff Bridges and John Goodman, but you get the sense when you watch them that they're not acting that much. They're not putting much effort.
That is really close to maybe who Jeff Bridges is.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that's again why those performances are so good, is that they do, I think, really good work, but they make it seem like it's really easy work.
Yeah.
So, who would be number one then
again, the dude is right there in the mix. But at the end of the day, when I think Coen Brothers, I think the first movie I think of is Fargo. And the reason I think of that movie first is because of Frances McDormand's performance as March Gunners.
Another Academy Award-winning performance.
I think that is – I mean, granted, when I think of Coen Brothers, there are probably about three movies that come to mind in some succession. Big Lebowski, Fargo, maybe No Country, and then Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, maybe four. But those are the four kind of go-to. If I think a little harder, I think of Raising Arizona. But I think Raising Arizona is kind of like that one that was kind of putting them on the map. But it wasn't really full-fledged, identifiable.
So they even knew what their voice was going to be necessarily.
Yeah. And I'm a big Hudsucker Proxy fan, too. I know some people are not, but I love that movie.
So why Frances McDormand and Fargo, real quick?
Just because it's such a quirky, offbeat, memorable character. When she's going out there to this crime scene and she's been over throwing up, and you think, oh my gosh, she's getting just morning sickness, and it's just such a bizarre just mixture of things. And also Fargo itself, one of the scariest scenes in some ways for me, one of the most terrifying things is the scene where he's killed the state trooper or whatever it is off the side of the road, and this other family just happens to just drive by and they're staring at, he hunts them down and that to me is terrifying. But it's like all you were doing was driving along this deserted road at the wrong time.
So the hero of the film is number one, and again another remarkable,
and again, iconic
role.
I don't have, this list could change on a weekly, next time you talk to me or whatever. I don't have it really firmly thought out.
There's no Brother Where Art Thou, which is a little surprising, but because Everett, Ulysses, McGill would be somewhere in my top five. But that's a good list nonetheless. And listeners, you can tell us what you think of Brian's list, what Coen Brother characters you consider to be among the very best by reaching out to us on Twitter at 10K, T-E-N-K Movies, or by going to Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. That's T-E-N-K Movies.com. Thank you so much again for joining us for this conversation of Faith on Film, Parts 1 and Parts 2. And we hope that as you go on and watch movies, you might take a little bit closer look at what's the message, and how well is that message being delivered? Until next time, though, we hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11. Have a good one, everybody.